Last year in the U.S., there were over 700,000 victims of child abuse and neglect. More than 4 children die each day in the U.S. as a result of child abuse. I was surprised by those figures. You've heard about Chicago last year, the number of people shot, almost 800 murdered in one city. The 20th century, the bloodiest century in human history, 260 million were killed in wars. 600,000 to 800,000 people are trafficked across international borders every year. 50% of those are children. There are 20 to 30 million slaves in the world today. Africa is a continent at war with itself, from North African countries to South Africa and everywhere in between. Sin ravages and takes the lives of millions of people. New York Times columnist Matthew Paris, who's an atheist, wrote in a widely discussed article, he said, "As an atheist, I truly believe that Africa needs God. Missionaries, not aid money, are the solution to Africa's biggest problem." And he grew up in Africa, and he says that it troubles his own worldview to realize that in Africa, Christianity changes people's heart. He said, "It brings spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is real." So it's astounding to hear a non-believer saying that the hope of a continent at war with itself is Christian missionaries. And he doesn't just mean they need hospitals and schools and missionaries bring, no. He's very specific. He said what Africa needs is heart change, and he's only seen Christian missionaries bring that. Now, it's odd because he doesn't really believe the heart change is a work of God, since he doesn't believe there is a God. But he's admitting that humans without even the idea of God don't do well, at least not in Africa. Humanity as a whole is not getting better, not really. World War I was not called World War I until World War II. Before that, it was called the Great War, or the war to end all wars. It's not worked out that way, has it? Slavery was outlawed in the UK in 1833, in America 32 years later. There are more slaves in the world now than ever before. 15,000 slaves are trafficked in the U.S. each year. People are better educated, have more health care, more cell phones, more TV channels, more air conditioning, more of everything. Yet the numbers that reflect evil continue to rise. And all these gloomy stats are metrics that support what Paul wrote to the Romans in the first century. And I give those to you to say what Paul wrote is not outdated, never will be outdated. Our need for God remains acute. And Matthew Paris was right, Africa needs God, but so does America and every other country. But not just God as a transformational idea, but God the transformational being, reality. In Romans 1, 18 to 32, Paul's going to jump from the good news to the bad news that makes the good news necessary. The first step of the 12-step AA program is to admit powerlessness over alcohol. And this is the first step because an honest awareness of need precedes any real help. And so for Paul to show that salvation is equally available to all people, which he's been talking about already, he has to show that all are equally in need of it. And he's not just piling on guilt here. He's driving us to a conclusion about our condition in hopes that people will accept the cure. Because one of the barriers to living in the freedom of the gospel, both for the non-believer looking at it from the outside in and from the believer living inside of it, is a lack of understanding of how utterly ruined we are without God. Even believers can forget that. So starting in verse 16, Paul unfolds his argument, tying together his thoughts with the Greek word is translated because and sometimes for. So let me summarize the flow of his argument from verse 16 to 20 so you'll get the lay of the land. Paul, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel." Well, why not, Paul? "Because it's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes." How is this so? "Because in the gospel, the righteousness from God is revealed. That is God's way of justifying sinners." But why is this necessary, Paul? "Because the wrath of God is being revealed against the godlessness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness." But how have people suppressed that truth, Paul? "Because what may be known about God is clear because God has made it known to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal nature, divine power, have been clearly seen from what has been made, so men are without excuse." So he's given us the good news, the gospel, but for the good news to look good, we have to see our ruined condition apart from God. And that's what he's going to do in 1 verse 18 all the way through chapter 3. Today we're in 1, 18 to 32. And the outline for this passage is the revelation of God's wrath, the reason for God's wrath, and the results of God's wrath. So read with me, if you would, Romans 1, 18. "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. That's a pretty heavy verse, especially when you, if you were here the last couple of weeks, you have Paul's cheerful announcement of good news for all people, and we would expect him to probably go to outline the blessings of salvation next, but he jumps shockingly straight into God's wrath. It's because you're not going to appreciate the good news until you understand the bad news. So what do you think, or what do you maybe feel when you hear God's wrath? What do you think people outside the church think or feel when they hear the phrase God's wrath? There was a British humanist bus campaign, humanist not as in humanitarian, but as in agnosticism or atheism, and they had signs on buses that said, "There's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life." When I saw that, my first thought was, it wouldn't be super comforting for me to hear, "There's probably no God," which means there might be, "but go ahead, roll the dice on the most important decision you'll ever make, because after all, there might not be anything to worry about eternally." Not all that encouraging. And then the second thing, it's super sad that the reality of God would be perceived as A, worry-producing, and B, stealing joy from your life, because in my life, the exact opposite's been true. But I think what's behind this is the fear of the wrath of God. For many, God's wrath sounds like God is really mean. And if he's really strong and really mean, that's really scary. So if I spend my life worrying that I might tick him off, it'd be hard to enjoy life because you're being watched by an all-powerful, angry being who probably doesn't like most of what I do, and he can make a lot of trouble for me. But the wrath of God doesn't mean God wakes up on the wrong side of the bed. It doesn't mean he experiences a rise in stress chemicals that cloud his judgment. It doesn't mean he's fickle. He's not mean. His wrath is his settled disposition against evil. The opposite of wrath is not love. It is passivity. And passivity is the opposite of divine love. So God's wrath is not cruel. It's not evil, but it is dangerous. Electricity is not mean, but it is dangerous if you don't handle it correctly. And that's why this bad news is so important in order to understand how good the good news is. So maybe a contrasting bus campaign would be, there is a God, his wrath is dangerous, so stop worrying by believing the gospel. Proverbs 9:10 says, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Fear is the anticipation of harm. And so to live outside of relationship with God is to put yourself in harm's way. Fear of God is the beginning of wisdom because to not worry at all about God, the reality of God, who he really is just not smart. His settled disposition against evil is dangerous for us apart from the gospel. That's what Paul is saying. And remember the line of thought. He started with the good news of the gospel, God's righteousness offered to all of us as our only hope. So he began with the cure. Now he has to convince of the curse. I had a friend, a young man, he was in his 30s, and he had a very treatable form of cancer. And he had many months of symptoms that something was wrong, but he refused to seek treatment. And by the time he finally did seek the cure, his cancer was no longer treatable and he died. And it was really important that my friend acknowledge his need, and his refusal to ever acknowledge his need cost him his life. And so the wrath of God is a description of a reality of God's nature. Some people rage against this idea, my God is love. Well, the God is love. And God has a settled disposition against evil, his wrath. It's important that we see our dangerous condition apart from the gospel. God's wrath is not God's meanness, but it is dangerous for humans to not take it seriously. And then the reason for God's wrath, verse 19 to 21, let's read that together. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. In verse 18, Paul spoke about people suppressing the truth. We don't suppress what we don't know. So the implication is people have access to the truth. That's what he's getting at. Now, why would anyone willingly suppress the truth? Well, I think the number one reason why is because they don't like it. We've all seen, I've seen little children lie or deny what's obvious. Sweetheart, pick up your coat you just threw on the floor. I didn't throw it on the floor. Okay, I'm thinking, I just saw you like 2 seconds ago. throw it on the floor in front of me. Yeah, you throw your coat on the floor, pick it up. It's not my coat. Thinking, I bought you the coat, and you were just wearing it. So children are terrible liars. They don't know how to deny the truth. It's very unsophisticated. But they don't want that to be true. I mean, they're three. They got a lot of things to do. They can't pick up coats off the floor. And adults get much more sophisticated. The reason is the same. They deny the truth because they just don't want it to be true sometimes. I remember reading of a university professor who, when challenged about his view on God in a personal conversation with a believer and his views on divine design, he said, I really don't have what I would call proof it's not a God. I don't have proof that life is undesigned. Matter of fact, evidence points that both of those things are actually true. Life is designed, there is a God. But I choose to not believe in God because it does not fit my lifestyle. He liked to sleep with a lot of different women. And the truth of God would have been very inconvenient for him. Not everybody's that blatant, but there's a part of that inside of most people or all people who turn from the truth of God. Augustine said, God being God offends human pride. The historian of Alcoholics Anonymous, he titled his book, Not God. Because he said, that stands as the most important hurdle an addicted person must surmount. To acknowledge deep in the soul that they are not God, they must quit playing God and allow God himself to play God. So what Paul's outlining here has been called general revelation or sometimes called natural revelation. It's a term used to describe the fact that God, some of who God is, can be made known by his created world, by what he's made. General revelation is called general revelation because it's open to everyone, everywhere, all the time. But it's nonspecific. It's you're not going to learn from the created order how to live to please God or how to be saved. We need the scriptures for that. But it is there for all to see that there's a God. Psalms 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they display language. There's no speech. There's no language where their voice is not heard. And so the point here is that God has revealed himself sufficiently in what he's made so that we're without excuse when we suppress the truth. Stephen Hawking is the world's most famous living scientist. He suffered for decades with ALS. And in his book, his most recent book, The Grand Design, he challenges belief in the divine creation of the universe. And he argues that the Big Bang was the inevitable consequence of the laws of physics. And so here's the thesis statement for his book. He says, because there's a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. If that sounds confusing, it's not because it's so profound. It's because it is nonsensical. John Lennox, a Northern Irish philosopher of science and professor of math at Oxford, addressed Hawking's statement in a book. And Lennox writes that Hawking, in his book, says that philosophy is dead. Science is the only thing that's real. Philosophy being the study of ultimate things. And then Lennox says, but then he makes a statement that's non-scientific and philosophical. Lennox asks, second, how does a law do anything? Laws describe things that occur in nature. They don't have actual power themselves. C.S. Lewis, long before Hawking lived, wrote, it's kind of like assigning power to laws is like doing math sums on a piece of paper in order to add to your bank account. See, laws describe, they don't do anything. And then finally, saying the universe can create itself is a statement of nonsense. The universe must exist before it exists in order to create itself. And Lennox wrote in conclusion, what all this goes to show is that nonsense remains nonsense, even when talked about by world-famous scientists. And so smart people sometimes deny the existence of God because it does not fit with what they decided they want to be true. I've spoken of Anthony Flew, the most influential philosopher of the last half of the 20th century. He was an atheist. And in his 80s, he began to believe there's a God because the evidence, the factual evidence for design was so obvious to him. And his followers raged against him despite the fact that the facts took him there. I don't want to get too far into this today, but what we see over and over is that when the facts veer in the direction of divine design, the response from some scientists is very unscientific. It becomes emotional, visceral. Humans suppress the truth because they don't like it. Verses 22 to 32 are the results of God's wrath. I'm not going to read the whole passage. It starts off like this. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools. And they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. And that's a repeat of the Genesis story. It's man and animals, those that fly, walk on the land. And so they traded the truth about the Creator for lies about the creation. And this is not just about making statues of lizards and idols that you worship. This is about worshiping what He's made instead of the Maker. Because He goes on and talks about the results of that. You start worshiping creation, you become that like that which you worship. And so they became sexually addicted. And He gives a whole list, a laundry list. You can read this sometime today if you'd like to, about the result of being handed over to their sins. And there's three stages in this death spiral in this passage. And he gives these three stages three times. They had a knowledge of God, verse 21, 25, and 28. They rejected that knowledge in favor of something else. God gave them over. They became like what they worshipped. In each case, people cast off the truth of God revealed in nature and replaced it with their own ideas of what would be good and valuable. And when you value what's not valuable, you experience ruin. This is the passage of tragedy. Exchanging the glory of God for images of what God has made. Exchanging the truth of God for lies. Exchanging the way God's designed human beings to work and to operate in relationship for what doesn't work. And the consequence was God gave them over to their demands. They demanded to cast off knowledge of Him. We're going to become wise in our own eyes, which is a repeat of what happened in the fall in the garden, and they became fools. And when it says God gave them over, there's some sense that this is just the laws of cause and effect taking place. I mean, if someone's running to a cliff, you don't have to like push them to help them. You can just get out of the way and not stop them. So there's a sense in which this is just saying God set up the world this way, this is cause and effect, but it's not just cause and effect. God is active in opposing evil. That's what His wrath means. And so God is involved in the world, and there is a consequence for this lifestyle. We become like what we worship. We become destroyed. This passage has a key New Testament reference to one of the hot-button issues for our day, homosexuality. So let me say a couple things about it. First, in spite of the fact that some try to read current trends back into the first century and interpret this passage creatively, Paul did in fact believe homosexuality was wrong, and he was teaching that fact here. Second, this passage is not primarily about homosexuality. It's about the consequences of suppressing the truth of God. In verse 24, he talks about sexual sins of all kinds. He doesn't just specify homosexuality. In addition, the first thing he takes aim at is idolatry. This applies to anything we allow to take first place in our hearts: jobs, fantasy football, cars, image, you name it. And then in this passage, after focusing on idolatry and then looking at sexual sins, which was as common a manifestation of idolatry then as it is now, Paul may have worried if some readers would say, I'm good to go. No idols in my house, and I'm not sexually immoral, I'm good to go. So he gives this long but not all-inclusive list of consequences of rejecting the knowledge of God. You can read it. There's a long list of sins. So you don't worship a statue? Good. Do you gossip? You're not engaged in sexual immorality? Are you arrogant and boastful? And so he widens the net, and we look up and realize we're all in the net, all of us. And so homosexuality issue is important when it's not the primary point of this passage. If you want to do some reading about it, I can suggest some helpful books. I've read some really good ones in the last couple of years. Or if you'd like some personal help, that's available as well. What this passage is about is a terrible exchange, a terrible trade. Have you ever gotten a really bad deal? Maybe you bought some clothes and they're, man, these are like 80% off and you can't take them back and they don't fit. Or they feel like you're wearing still wool. And so you got a great deal. They didn't cost anything, but you can't even wear them. Maybe you bought a car that's a limit. Maybe you got a house that you regret. Maybe you traded a job for a job and you regret. In all those, you traded something for something else. And it was a bad trade. Whenever you buy something and you realize it was a bad exchange, what happens was you gave your life for that thing. You say, no, I didn't. Yeah, if you work, you get money, you buy something. What is work? Time. What is time? Your life. So you traded your life for that. And you go, what a horrible trade. I gave my life for this? And this passage in Romans is a description of the worst exchange ever. The truth and reality and beauty and freedom of God for bondage and brokenness. Idols take our lives, God gives us life. Idols are like those are like those mythical sirens, you know, on the islands where they're calling out to the sailors, and they have their sensual, beautiful song, and then when they get over there, these things devour the sailors. It's interesting, it's instructive, it's sad to realize that those who pursue idols, primarily they pursue idols of self-pleasure, eventually lose the ability to be pleased by anything. And this is not just biblical, this is something you can find out in hard science, that it changes people's minds and the way their brains are wired. They pursue pleasure, and pretty soon nothing brings them pleasure. They chase feelings, and pretty soon they can't even get feelings at all. Proverbs says, the eye of man is never satisfied, like a leech or a fire. How much is enough? More. On the other side are those who seek to find their pleasure in the life of God, and they're pleased by more and more. Gratitude and contentment pursue those who pursue God. Psalm 23 says, goodness and love are going to follow me around as I follow the shepherd around. Idolatry changes the entire spiritual and moral landscape. People who wrap their hearts around idols start seeing the world in a totally different light. They become the center, or what they've idolized becomes the center, and it's this relentless drive to get what they desperately think they need to have life becomes the engine that ruins them. John Calvin said, the surest source of destruction to men is to obey themselves. So, Sigmund Freud wrote that faith in God is a wish fulfillment. It's a delusion to help us deal with our problems and fears. This, of course, is true if God doesn't exist. If God does exist, then unbelief becomes a delusion. There's a German psychiatrist wrote a best-selling book called God, A Brief History of the Greatest One. And he was countering He was countering Freud's explanation for belief in God. And he said, by the same token, if God does not exist, then it is atheism that is the comforting delusion, the flight from facing reality. It is a projection of the desire not to meet God one day and give account for your life. Karl Marx wrote that religion is the opium of the people. It's the drug to keep them suppressed and dull and dumb. And there was a Polish Nobel Prize winner, a poet, who lived through the horrors of the communist world. He was a Poland, and he saw what happened when atheism was forced down people's throats. A lot of people died. He wrote this, a true opium of the people is a belief in nothingness after death, the huge solace of thinking that for our betrayals, greed, cowardice, murders, we are not going to be judged. Thus, if God does exist, atheism can be seen as a psychological escape mechanism to avoid taking ultimate responsibility for one's own life. I think that's well said. Many don't see because they don't want to see. Paul talked about a horrible exchange here, a really bad trade, the truth and glory of God for an empty life. No one gets out of life alive. Unless the Lord returns in our lifetime, everyone everywhere is going to die. And everyone everywhere is hour by hour trading their life away. We're spending our life hour by hour. And in the end, there's a really bad exchange, my life for a lie, a really good exchange, my life for truth. So let me give you one point of application this morning. The whole world believes, every human being lives by faith. And that's just incontrovertible. You cannot deny that. You say, well, I know non-believers, well, they believe in nothing without evidence. Spiritual formation is not something that's happened to the religious people, those pursuing Jesus. Everyone everywhere is being formed spiritually, because we're spiritual beings. You take the worst human being on the planet to the most selfless, Christ-honoring person, all have had and are undergoing spiritual formation. They're becoming ruined souls more and more and more, or they're becoming like Christ more and more. And we're all have become and are becoming a certain kind of person as we're trading our lives for truth or trading our lives for lies. We're all believing certain things, and then in turn we're valuing certain things, and then we go out and we live in certain ways because of what we believe and value. And when you believe a lie, you value what's worthless. When you value what's worthless, you live a wasted life. Now, I think I'm preaching to the choir here. That means telling people who already are doing and believing what they should be doing and believing. That's not what I'm doing. I know that most of you, the vast majority of you, believe Jesus is the Christ. And most of you, the vast majority of you, value what's valuable: loving God and loving people. And you're doing your best to live your lives that way. So there's no rebuke here this morning. Only encouragement. You don't need me. If you're like me, you spent plenty of time this week feeling guilty about stuff. Last thing you need is for this dude to help you feel guilty. The truth is, if we are guilty, we take it to the cross and we're forgiven and we move on. So there's no rebuke here. I'm encouraging you. Keep believing what's true, valuing what's valuable, and living with the end in mind. And day to day, it feels rather ordinary, but never mind all that. You're on track for a good exchange, a well-lived, well-spent life. So be encouraged, be faithful. Keep making the good trade. You're a follower of Jesus. If you're a follower of Jesus, you've made a good trade. Keep making the good trade. Let's pray together. If you came in here with a weight of guilt, a truckload of guilt, then lay it at the cross right now. Leave it here. Don't walk out of here with it.